Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Future Library. It's been a couple of weeks since the last one. The reason being, listeners, as I'm sure you know, if I mentioned it in the last show, which I might have done because it was, I don't know, maybe I didn't, but I've moved house and it's all been a bit of a chaos. So for the last month, things have been in boxes. I've been everywhere. When I say everywhere, I mean, well, actually, I've put on a lot of weight, so I could have been everywhere, which is not a good thing. It's not a pretty sight. But anyway, let's get on with the show. Tonight I have two guests. They are both originating from Scotland. The first one is, how to describe him? He's his music is, he's prolific. He's made a lot of records over the years. It goes from pop through to kind of very odd dance music through to kind of almost baroque stuff. It's by turns witty, almost kind of knowingly sleazy at times. He's known as Nick Curry to some, but Momus to others. Hello, Momus.
Hello there.
Thank you ever so much for joining us. My other guest hails from Glasgow, is now living in Liverpool. Some people will be familiar with him from his from his days in My Legendary Girlfriend, a band in Glasgow, and others from his solo work under the name Magaz. More recently, he's gone out under the name Panther Solo. It's Paul McGarrigle. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
So I'm very grateful for both of you coming onto the show. Rather than me kind of gibbering on in a kind of ever increasingly unknowledgeable way, I'll let you give a little bit of background, each of you. Let's start with the person who's left on my screen. Let's go with you. Do you prefer Momus or Nick?
Why not Momus?
Yeah. Okay, Momus is good for me. That's what me and the missus call you in the house all the time. So when she's walking around singing your songs. So yes, Momus, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'm speaking to you from Edinburgh, which is basically where I'm from, although I don't live there. I live in Japan most of the time. And I started my musical career here when I formed a band with ex-members of Joseph K, the Postcard Records band, in the early 80s. We didn't stay together very long in the spirit of Joseph K, who also didn't stay together. And then I went solo when I moved to London in 1984 as Momus, and have been making prodigiously unsuccessful records ever since, in a commercial sense, but you know, I mean, survival itself is a form of success. So I think I've made 27 albums as Momus, but also diversified into writing books and doing weird performances like emotional lectures and unreliable tours, one of which I'm giving tomorrow actually in Glasgow. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Fantastic. And it's actually something we've touched on in the show before, is what is success? And the conclusion we've come to on previous episodes is that if you're still doing what you want to do many years after starting, you're successful.
You do what you want, and if anyone else likes it, it's a bonus.
it's almost a weekly Melody Maker cliche from the 90s.
It is indeed.
Some band with centre-parted hair from Daventry, who were possibly called Mung Bean Jesus, telling everybody how what they do is just for themselves and anybody else liking it is a bonus. But it's true. After a certain point, it's a cliche when you're younger, and then it becomes true as you get older. I mean, I've recently turned 40, and you know, the fact that I'm still doing it, I feel that's a success. I don't care that I'm not making any money out of it. And, you know, the people I knew who were really careerist when I was younger are all working for banks and stuff now and don't play their music at all anymore. So, in your face, people who I used to know, we win. So, Paul, tell us a bit about yourself. What have you been doing?
Well, next to Momus, I'm going to sound a bit rubbish by comparison. I, as you know, we met in, I think it was 2000, at a gig, and I was playing in a band called My Legendary Girlfriend, who were about for about 7 years, I think, sort of the latter stages of the 90s and the early part of the noughties. We spent the first half of our career sort of trying to do what we thought was groundbreakingly innovative stuff, which mostly sounded like sort of Tears for Fears with breakbeats on it. And then the second half of our career, we decided to have fun instead. And we were essentially a kind of very, very poor Stranglers tribute band. but that was so much more enjoyable than all the sort of, you know, the very kind of earnest sort of, you know, why don't we mix up ska with drum and bass and see how it sounds and stuff like that. It was actually just more fun, just being, you know, a bit pubby. So I did that for a while, and then I went solo, as it were, and did about five albums as Magaz, which is just me sitting at my computer trying to be a bit like Momus, probably, and sounding more like sort of sounding a bit like Jesse Ray meets Dalek Eye or something like that. And then more recently, I've just done what all old indie guys do and just become sort of electronica dance type producer. And I haven't, you know, unlike Momus, I am not prodigious in my output. And my main musical endeavour is coming up with excuses as to why I haven't done more stuff. So I'm either blaming sort of exploding computers or, you know, other events in my life. Or I was talking to you earlier about how my sound card exploded on me and just decided it wouldn't communicate with any other device.
But I do remember you did manage to get a song out of the death of one of your computers.
Yes,
you
that
moved
was the
from Scotland to Liverpool.
That was the one that fell out of the back of the van. It literally fell off the back of a lorry.
So I take it was a shifting furniture in the back of a lorry. Incident.
Yeah, like I was responsible for getting the cats along with the furniture down to Liverpool. And so we put the cats in their boxes in the back of the van. And I think we were at a motorway service station somewhere. And I thought, I better open the back of the van and give the cats a bit of fresh air. And the weight had shifted. So I opened the thing and the PC sort of came flying past me at head height.
Oh.
And it kind of landed and skidded along the ground. And I thought, it might still be all right.
I can imagine you going, it's still good, it's still
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it was exactly like that. You know, the horrible thing was, I eventually managed to rig it all up again, switched it on, and it worked for about a minute, and then it died.
Oh, that's a shame. Momus, do you have any similar stories of computer-related woe?
No, I've been very lucky with my computers. I mean, I've had data loss, and I wrote a song about data loss called Data Panic, which was really basically a rewrite of Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again, or whatever it's called. He's singing about the death of his parents, but I'm singing in an equally tragic tone about the death of a hard drive, which is these days really the death of a whole host of memories and connections with your friends. So it's I think it's reduced many people to tears, and people only realize what a good song it is when they lose their data.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you hit on something that's absolutely the case these days, that we're so reliant on our devices and our hard drives that that kind of clicking sound they make when they start to fail is, I don't know what it's almost analogous to from the past. I don't know what sound people 100 years ago would have heard that would have caused the same sense of fear. Maybe their house burning down or something.
It wouldn't have been an equivalent thing. Like, I know there were there was a guy called is it Israel Tong, the guy's name was, and he was a fanatical Puritan in the time of so the Restoration, and what drove him from being a kind of ordinary preacher to a fanatical type was that his library was destroyed by a fire, and he had invested everything that he owned in collecting, you know, knowledge and books, and it just took this one event to wipe the whole thing out, and that's what flipped him over the edge.
You see, that to my mind, makes me feel the same kind of level of fear. It's the thought of losing a hard drive or something. I think part of it's because I remember hearing this on Radio 4, which I've started listening to a lot since I've turned old. I remember them talking about the fact that we've shunted off a lot of our kind of brain capacity into our devices. So
they're doing the work for us, so yeah, we're relying on them more.
Yeah, so when we lose that stuff, it's like we're losing part of ourselves.
It's funny because I'm here in front of, I've got three hard drives in front of me. I've got the one in the PC itself. I've got a backup, and I've got a backup of the backup, because that's how scared I am of losing all my stuff.
I've just had this issue with various different generations of my family, because I'm staying with my mother, and she bans tablets and laptops and phones from the dinner table, at least while people are eating. But now I'm at my sister's house, where actually everybody sits at dinner, because it's all my nephews and nieces who are teenagers and things. We've all got these screens in front of us, and our brains are sort of interfacing the whole time with somebody. You know, I'm talking to you and on the other side of the world, whatever. And that's, I feel much closer to that younger generation way of doing things, where that's not considered rude. There's a new etiquette where it's perfectly fine to have a computer on and be doing something at the same time as eating and socializing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's me and my wife will sit on the sofa watching the telly, or sometimes we'll be streaming something via Netflix through our Apple TV. We'll be both have our MacBooks on our laps. We'll both have iPads and phones next to us as well. All of these things on. And you know, it's just become what we do. I mean, I've actually managed to get my mother, who's in her late 60s now. She's now got a tablet, and she loves it. She's all over that kind of thing. She has her laptop and stuff. And I think there's certain people of that generation, if they embrace it, become really excited by it, where some people kind of go, no.
Well, my mum's into it. When I took photographs of the family photograph album that she's got right there on her shelf, and then started sort of enlarging them with my fingers on the tablet, she's suddenly enchanted by that and says, oh, they look great. They look so much better on the screen than they do in the album.
Yeah, so it's finding the app that brings somebody into something, isn't it? It's the, you know, it's the thing that person makes the connection with. Whether it's a game, or it's a, you know, being able to manipulate pictures or whatever, there'll be a use for something that someone will think, ah, and that's the thing that brings them in.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think one of the things that's happened as well is that since we've kind of got more into, you know, laptops and phones and tablets that belong to the individual rather than being the family computer, we're far more personally invested in our computing devices.
Tech.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the musician Holly Herndon said that she does computer music, and she does things where she occasionally bows the case of her computer and stuff. And she says that the way she thinks about her computer is that it's actually the most personal object that she owns, and that it's the most personal object that anybody owns. It's because it's not just their instrument if they use it to make music. It's the thing they communicate with their families through. It's the thing that they keep their memories on. It's the thing that they make their little posters for their church groups with. It's the thing that, you know, like ourselves, that we record on, and you know, all this stuff in this one little box, which is the size of an A4 pad of paper, that we carry around with us wherever we go and start to feel a little bit...
But things like... Radios and record players went through that as well, because my mum was telling me, I asked my mum sort of naively, what records did you buy when you were, you know, a teenager and listened to in the family stereo? And she said, well, she wasn't allowed to even touch the radio or the stereo. Those were the preserve of her dad, and they called the radio the Wobert for some reason, and only he could touch the Wobert in the corner, and it was like this sacred thing which, you know, you needed a degree to actually operate, and she couldn't operate it. So only much later on, the radios got smaller and smaller, till they were in the 60s, you know, transistor radios you could carry in your pocket and listen to individually on a little earphone.
Yeah, and it's things like that, I think, that have... Yeah, I think it's... I think in some ways a lot of people have said, oh, no, it's really bad, it's me, and everybody's looking down at the devices all the time and stuff. And I think, yeah, there is a small amount of that, but I personally find myself far more in touch with people I've been friends with for years through the internet and things than I was when if it was just the phones. I mean, like, you know, a good example is Paul. Is, you know, I've managed to stay in touch with Paul even though we now live in completely different places. We've both moved completely away from the place where we met, and you know, I know what he's doing day to day, and I can read what he's putting on Twitter and stuff, and you know, we know what everybody's doing, and I think we've got a connection that maybe didn't exist before.
We're communicating with more people. It's just, it may not be the people we're physically sitting next to.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's more and greater communication going on, but it's not space located. It's, you know, it doesn't tie you to particular, you don't have to talk to the boring person sat next to you if there's a million people out there on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think the things that people say about it are not necessarily right. I like the fact that I can keep in touch with people. I like the fact that this information is available to me all the time. I have no shame in saying that I'm one of these people that if I haven't checked my email for 5 minutes or haven't looked at Facebook or Twitter or whatever, I start to get anxious. And in a way, that's probably something I should be worried about. But in another way, I kind of think of it, well, you know, I'm finding out what people are doing. And I think it's a side effect of this culture that we're now in where we want to know what's going on all the time. And I think this is where things like Google Glass are going to come in, you know, in 5 years' time when everybody's pair of glasses has it built into the lenses or it's in contact lenses or whatever, and we're all constantly connected to...
It'll be impossible to get away from it at that point.
Yeah, but then at that point, I think you embrace it, don't you? I think you can either rally against it or...
Well, yeah, I think there's a slippery slope and sort of the Borg from Star Trek are at the bottom of that slope. And it's, well, you know, there's just this gradual acceptance of being constantly networked.
Go on, Mamish, you're going to say something.
Well, I was going to say there's a short story by Borges called The Aleph, in which is this magical thing which exists in a basement, a sort of little spy hole where you can see the whole world simultaneously and you can know everything and sort of become omniscient like God. And in a way, we want the internet to be the Aleph. But I think it's hiding as much as it's showing. It's just we don't really see the unknown unknowns. We don't know what we're not seeing because of the internet, because we're so focused on the information we are getting. But what we are getting, I mean, if I speak for myself, is kind of quite trivial stuff. It's just what people are having for lunch, or, you know, it's not, I don't really think that I'm learning Dostoevskian truths about people's lives because of Twitter, or, you know.
No, I have to confess, my very first tweet was in related to something I'd read in the blog Speak Your Brains, where he'd commented, the guy who wrote that all of Twitter was just people writing about what they'd had for lunch and going to the toilet. And he gave the example of just did a boring shit. And my first ever tweet was just did a boring shit. I felt that was the appropriate thing to do. And I didn't get Twitter for a really long time, and I just ignored it for ages. And I disparaged anybody who used it. And now I've hit over so many hundreds, tens of thousands of tweets or whatever it is. I've clearly been sucked into that as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is just...
The one out of every 1,000 tweets will have some, you know, profound, incredibly concise statement in it, and then the other 999 will be just did a boring shit or whatever, so that it's in there. But that's what conversation with people is usually like.
Well, that's
nobody,
true. Yeah.
Nobody speaks only in profound truths.
No, I mean, at work we'll sit and chat about just, you know, the weather and telly and stuff, and I suppose it's just taking that up to a global scale, is, you know.
But I should ask... I should ask Magaz, because Magaz was a fantastic contributor to Click Opera, which was my blog, which finished in 2010. And I do miss those days, because I think we had something a bit more interesting going on there than Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, I stopped it, and I do regret its passing. But I think it had to stop at that time for me personally, and also because blogs just kind of went out of fashion, and Live Journal went out of fashion, and the action moved elsewhere. But I don't know if I've really found anything as good as that elsewhere.
There are still a few blogs, I think, where there's and it tends to be a kind of small coterie of people who have a kind of, you know, they'll vaguely know each other, and you'll get a certain higher standard of conversation because everyone can kind of assume certain things about the others. But they're few and far between now, I think. You certainly don't have it in the way you used to.
I don't quite know why it got smashed up. It got smashed up because of social media becoming wider and more easily accessible. So maybe that kind of propeller-heady, you know, the really clever people who are usually Star Trek fans and all the rest of it, or Doctor Who fans or whatever, have become the minority rather than the majority they used to be.
Or that's definitely a thing, isn't it? I mean, the broadening of the...
Yeah,
the
it's a broader church.
The internet.
Mm-hmm. There's just everybody on there now. Here comes everybody. Yeah, it's all your family are on there, and it's become just much more... Fatic, I think, or is it fatic? Yeah, I don't know how you pronounce that. It's just like, hi, how are you doing, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's like somebody said Facebook was the site where you'd find all the people you got into the internet to get away from in the first place.
Yeah.
Like that was the problem. The internet was like a thing you could go off and do, and, like, you know, it was only some of you that did it, and now it's, you know, it's weird to not be on the internet.
It was kind of the Asperger's syndrome sufferers who were all clinging together on the internet, and now it's just the normal people, yeah.
The normal people just turn up and take advantage of all the sort of, you know, work and ground rules and things that other people have come up with, and they saunter in and go, just did a boring shit or whatever. And like, we were talking about, you know, something highbrow a minute ago. You've ruined it.
Well, you know, boring shits have a habit of doing that. The thing is, I mean, you're absolutely right. There was something, what you were saying there just reminded me of the days of things like in Scotland, the Jock Rock Forum. And like you say, Momus, the whole thing with LiveJournal, when it was smaller social groups, but people were a bit more invested in what was going on. I mean, I remember the Jock Rock days. Things got really heated back on that message board many years ago.
But you could also get some very funny threads as well. Like, I mean, people, yeah, I remember people coming out with hilarious things.
Yeah.
And it required a certain amount of kind of insider knowledge that, you know, a random person in the street wouldn't get. Like, you know, like we did post-rock news.
Yes.
And, you know, there's jokes in there about people we knew in Glasgow, which, you know, are hilarious if you're vaguely involved in that scene, but will make no sense to anyone from outside.
It's one of those things that I'm so proud of what we wrote with that I regularly republish it on various forums.
Support comes from pro forma, things like that. Yeah, always, you know, they still make me laugh years later.
Yeah, it was always stuff. And it was like the one, I think one of them was... just a simple line, Mercury Tilkswitch are a rock-type band from Dundee, because a review had been written of them saying they were a rock-type band. And it was, these little kind of in-jokes, you're absolutely right, all these little in-jokes that made us all laugh. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly the same on blogs. It'd be, you could run these little in-jokes for months and years. Mm-hmm. And now on Facebook and Twitter...
Your mum turns up and like says, "Well, who are Mercury Tilkswitch?" And, you know... And then some random guy from school says something else, and you know, the moment is gone.
Yeah.
I think it was. I remember staying up all night, trembling, wondering what people were going to say because I'd sent something vaguely controversial on a bulletin board. And those days are definitely gone. I mean, I couldn't give a difficult shit about it now. But that, there was a certain. It was like an intellectual gymnasium because I'd been to university and I'd sort of. Wrestled with ideas and things, but I hadn't taken them into the marketplace. I hadn't actually taken them into, you know, for instance, the freedom of speech issue. I got in big trouble just being somebody who thought anyone should be able to say anything. And then you meet people who don't believe that, and it's the first time you've ever met somebody who takes an anti-free speech stance, you know, and they realize that they start to really hate you because you just consistently want people to be able to say anything.
There was a thing I read recently about, I think it was about Amanda Palmer, who's covered one of your songs. But it said, there was a big row about some stuff that had been said on her website, or some stuff she had said on her website.
About Miley Cyrus?
I have no idea what it was about.
Was it the awful poem she wrote about the
It
Boston
might have been
bomber.
A poem, actually, that rings a bell. Yeah. But somebody was saying, if this was like 20 years ago, maybe... That wouldn't be on the internet. That would be through some sort of, you know, things she would publish, and it would be probably posted on paper to her fans, and her fans who, you know, aren't going to question anything she comes out with are going to go, "Oh, it's a nice poem," or they might just ignore it. But because it's on the internet, people can stumble across that. So you have these little, like someone said, was it the thing about... People said that the internet would, you know, break down all sorts of boundaries and walls and whatnot because people from all over the world with different opinions and outlooks would communicate. But the reverse actually happened, and everyone who held some particularly extreme or you know, singular view could find all the other people in the world who held that same view, and they could all club together and create kind of echo chambers. But what happens is somebody from outside can then stumble across one of these. Like, Alex, you have a lot of fun with... fundamentalist Christians.
You're absolutely right with the whole thing with echo chambers. They are fundamentalist Christians and creationists, especially. This is kind of a weird crossover with my other podcast, which is, I'll just quickly plug it. It's called Fundamentally Flawed. But that, I mean, we found on that show that the echo chamber has become the kind of place that these guys run to, and certainly when you've got forums where they can then control who posts, they will And they will. You know, if they're given the opportunity to censor people, they'll just do it at the drop of a hat. So many creationist Facebook pages will not allow posting from people who aren't members of it. And if you express any opinion that's contrary to the one that they hold, you get banned and all your posts deleted. So
it's not even so much the censorship, though, as like people will reinforce each other's views. And I think almost if you've got a closed community like that, people then, you know, reinforce each other and maybe try and outdo each other. So you get a group of people and, you know, this guy says, oh, I'm a Christian. He's a Christian community. And they start saying, oh, I didn't know that. And this guy's saying that. Bloody, I didn't know that. And they pick up all the stuff off each other. And it, you know, it makes their views more and more. They get sort of disconnected from the rest of, you know, the internet or the rest of the world or whatever. And it becomes self-reinforcing. And you don't realise, I think, when you're in a little closed group like that, how different your views can be from everyone else's.
But I think also just the whole idea that, that opinions are important, that really dominated the last decade. And then I suddenly, around about when I finished Click Opera, just lost interest in my own opinions. Does it really matter what I think? And also the whole idea of opinions just began to seem really silly to me, because it seems to me like for instance, if you're a sexist or if you're an anti-sexist, it's almost the same thing, because there's so much sexism built into anti-sexism. And all these people are fighting and investing ego and you know, about their special opinions, and which they've apparently arrived at through just thinking, you know, independently about things. But they're all framing the issues in the same way, and it's that framing which is really the important thing. And so, I just lost interest in opinion, and I started getting interested in texture and, well, in lies. I think lies have been to this decade what opinions were to last decade. I mean, I was making good money writing opinion columns and commentaries and things for various publications last decade, which I've largely stopped doing. And I'm much more interested in just sort of, you know, breathing and seeing colors and looking at shapes and telling lies, especially because lies sort of generate outrageous, not opinions, but sort of collisions of information.
Well, that quite neatly brings us on to a couple of the books you've written recently, because you've written kind of, I don't know how you describe them, almost like fake, or I don't know if fake's the right word, but imaginative travel guides, would you describe them as, or history books?
Yeah, they're kind of histories of the future and speculative fictions about possible futures and parallel worlds, which are generated by lying. And I've written one about Scotland, one about Japan, and I'm writing one about America now, although not for the same series. So
I saw a Scottish nationalist mention the Book of Scotland as a sort of example of, you know, the positive new way in which Scotland saw itself.
Right. Well, I don't mind that.
I'm not entirely sure if that's what this guy had in mind, but
yeah, I don't mind. I mean, I'm a yes person when it comes to independence, so I don't mind that. It's probably Jerry Hassan you're talking about.
That's the guy, yes.
He's been banging a drum very loudly about the Book of Scotland's, you know, bless him. I don't mind people using it that way, but it doesn't really have a stance. It's got a lot of it's a broken mirror, and each shard of glass reflects a kind of impossible reality, really. But I did write it in the lead up to the independence vote and the debates that were going on, and I thought they were a bit restricted and realistic, and I wanted something a bit crazier, more delirious. So I think of them as delirious speculative fictions.
And you also do the unreliable tour things, don't you? Where you're conducting a tour guide. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that started in the Whitney Biennial in 2006, and I was just employed really by the Whitney Museum to guide people around and tell lies about the show, because people tend to, they're a bit sheep-like in museums, and they stand there reading the didactic text as if it were, you know, Moses tablets. And so to have somebody with a bullhorn standing behind them spouting bullshit was actually quite refreshing. And then it's sort of spread into other contexts. So, for instance, the last couple of Edinburgh festivals, there's been this audio tour where you could take Edinburgh buses to the end of the line and listen to me guiding you apparently around Ocean Terminal or Nidri or somewhere. But in fact, there's just this outlandish landscape which didn't really exist. So kind of juxtaposition of an imaginary landscape, which is in a way what you know, the more you get into this lying, the more you realize that realtors, which are supposedly authoritative, are just doing exactly the same thing, but you know, with a slightly more po face.
It kind of reminds me of something I hadn't thought about for a while. Was back in the day, I used to work for Directory Inquiries for BT. I used to do the night shift, and we didn't have any managers on. So you could kind of get away with an awful lot. And it became a habit between a lot of us to just tell outrageous fibs about the numbers we were giving out. So if it was a company, you'd put a little fact about the company in just before you gave them the number. Like Star Cabs in Belfast, you'd say, oh yeah, it's called that because it was set up by a former member of Thin Lizzy, and he just employs former members of Derry Rock Bands. You know, look out next time you're being driven. It might be a member of that Petrol Emotion.
And well, that keeps people on their toes, but it can also be infuriating. It's like your nightmare uncle who just turns everything into a leg pool. But you know, I think it's refreshing if it's unimaginatively like anything. You know.
Well, it was one. The thing with that, it was everybody that we spoke to, it was just a one-off time we'd speak to them for like 10 seconds, and it became like a little bit of thing we'd do amongst us to see what the most outrageous fib you could get past somebody.
Well, and this is why you now get the message that this conversation is being monitored for quality control purposes.
Yes.
Because of people like you.
Yeah, I've ruined call centres for everybody. But maybe that's a good thing as well. Maybe ruining call centres is...
Well, we need to redefine quality as, you know, the quality of damn good lies.
Yes, absolutely. So, Paul, you've recently come back to actually doing music after a while.
I sort of just used moving house and not having a PC and things as excuses not to do anything. And then, again, having sound card problems, I decided I'd do an album without singing. So that's why I did an instrumental electronic album instead. And plus, that's closer to what I was listening to anyway. I was, you know, I wasn't really listening to crafted songs from people so much. I was listening to things which were, you know, more about the sound and the texture and the rhythms rather than the words or the chords. So it just followed what I was listening to anyway, I think.
And I think it's something, you said something interesting earlier about that you said that you did the thing that all kind of aging indie people do, which is going to electronic. And I think it's absolutely right. I mean, how would you describe yourself, Moments? Would you say you've come from that kind of guitar background into gradually more electronica stuff?
Well, everything's electronic now to the extent that it's all digitally recorded. But I've come full circle back to what I was doing in the 70s in my bedsit, just around the corner from here, actually, in Drummond Place. I had a broken guitar and a broken down piano, and I'd sort of stick microphones under the guitar strings, and it was all a bit John Cage and a bit Eno. And my new album actually sounds like that, and I've stopped using MIDI, stopped using reverb to a large extent. I still use distortion. But that really pleases me, that things sound really handmade now, although they're digitally recorded, or precisely because you can make everything so glossy on an iPad, or, you know, anyone has access to the standard battery of digital effects. But so precisely the handmade and the broken and the kind of stumbling is interesting. I was actually sitting in a church this afternoon. I stumbled into a totally dark church just across from Waverley Station, and there was an organist playing. He was obviously rehearsing, didn't think anyone else was in there listening, except for God, of course. And I was there, and he was getting everything wrong, and I started recording him because it was actually so fantastic when he got things wrong, much more interesting than when you would get things right.
I think that from what you were saying a moment ago, Paul, about, you know, necessity of broken equipment, that seems to tie into that a little bit. So, you know.
Yeah, if you're sort of limited to what you have, you know, always having constraints is always a good thing.
Yeah.
I think with me, weirdly, I'm going the opposite direction to Momus. I'm listening to things which kind of make a virtue of the fact of the sort of the standard sort of digital, you know, palette sort of sound. You know, so I'm listening to a lot of stuff at the moment that uses, yeah, your bog standard electro TR-808 drum sounds, but instead of just using them as a beat, it foregrounds them, so the drums are mixed too high in the tracks, they're not, you know, reverbed, they're very, you know, jarring and kind of in your face. Or you've got tracks that you've got a sample that doesn't quite loop properly, or the loop chops off, and it's foregrounding the fact that it's being you know, produced electronically. It's being produced via computer. It's not handmade, and it's making a virtue out of the fact that it's not handmade. I think that's another interesting way to do it.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, I mean, because I mean, for myself, I mean, as you know, Paul, I've come from playing in noisy guitar bands to doing...
Well, I remember when I first met you, you were recording a whole band in someone's attic with one mic hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah, it's something and like that, yeah.
Yeah, and you've gone from that to doing entire albums on laptops.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, I don't know, I think part of it is that I've kind of lost interest in ever being in a band again. And maybe that's something that happens as you get older, that I think if you've, and again, I can only really speak for myself in this, and I don't know if either of you will agree with it, but I think if you've been used to being the kind of the front person of a band, over time, the ego that drives that eventually kind of has to force out any other creative voice a little bit. And occasionally you can go, yeah, I'll collaborate with that person, but you do it on your own terms and stuff. But again, that's me speaking for myself. And I don't know if either of you have experienced that or have anything similar happening.
I'm not sure if it was ego. I mean, I think in my case, it was the fact that I physically relocated and it would have been a bit of a commute to go and meet up with the rest of them. But I think I'd hate to think that if I still lived in Glasgow now, I'd be trundling along to some sort of, you know, BO-ridden rehearsal room every week and sort of, you know, trudging through the set or whatever, I think. I'd like to think I'd have given up on that by now.
Man, just even mentioning that gives me a slight feeling of the fear, the sense of the rehearsal room and the, okay, let's do the set, let's do the songs again. Okay, so Momus, what's your take on it?
Well, my experience of bands was not that they were a collaborative process at all, because I was basically writing everything and dictating the bass and guitar parts and everything but the drum parts, basically, which were not super creative. So, I mean, maybe I didn't have a good experience of being in a band, but we just seemed to get worse the more we rehearsed and nobody was particularly interested. So it just made sense, and economic sense as well. I'm mean and Scottish, and I like to have a live show which basically plays off my iPhone, you know, and can project videos and the sound, and I just sing along on top of that. So keeping things cheap and compact and flexible is really sweet for me.
Absolutely. I think the simplification of things is definitely something that technology has helped with. I mean, it must be about a month and a half ago, I was up in Liverpool and saw Paul. And we went and saw Lucky Dragons play at the Blue Coat.
Oh, yeah.
And we've had Luke and Sarah on the podcast two or three episodes back. And Luke was saying after the show in Liverpool that he's trying to simplify everything as much as he can. And... you know, and he's really, I mean, since I first saw Lucky Dragons, which was in Dundee in 2004, I think, certainly things have simplified. And it's, you almost get the feeling that Luke, if he could do it with just some kind of single sensor attached to his hand or something, would do that. And I think maybe the kind of making things simpler to use is a good thing. And I agree with what you're saying about using iPhones and stuff, having something that you'd normally have with you anyway, as your tool for playing a show is a fabulous thing. I think I'm all for that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to insert complexity in a slightly different area. I mean, Lucky Dragons are a good example because they do a show which is very unexpected and kind of straddles a lot of different areas. It's kind of art and it's kind of therapy and it's, you know, it's music as well. But I think that's, you know, given that, you can inject simplicity in the delivery. Although he does some stuff with technology which is not simple.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with Luke's stuff is the... the stuff he's written using Max MSP is, I've no idea how you'd do that.
You know, yeah, Max MSP is
a steep learning curve on Max MSP. I think it's there's people who know how to do that and there's people who don't. It's one of those things.
I'm one of those people who doesn't.
I have.
Well, it's like a mutual friend of ours, Joe Howe, I think is one of these people who does know how to do it or is teaching himself to do it and has been.
Yeah, Joe probably does.
Yeah, because
it's a knack.
I'm actually performing with Joe.
I'm sorry, Momus?
I'm performing with Joe tomorrow night. I mean, I'm doing an emotional lecture and Joe's doing music separately at the Glasgow College of Art.
Actually makes me think of something. That's a good point that you've reminded me of something. You did a show a few years ago, I seem to remember, where the intention was you were going to kind of try and show the writing or creating process of an album. Am I remembering that correctly?
The first art show I had in New York in 2000 was just before Folktronic came out, and we put some teepees in a gallery with digital recorders inside, and people were meant to go into one tent and listen to some songs from Folktronic, and then they went into another tent and recorded their misremembered or mistaken versions of the songs, or deliberately improvised new versions of the songs. So it's trying to reproduce the Chinese whispers effect of the oral folk tradition in the gallery.
Yeah, and you did the thing with Joe, didn't you? I seem to remember. Was it when you were in Berlin? You
did. We did an album together, and then we did another one later. And yeah, and that was a more straightforward musical collaboration.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to remember is I think there was a gig you did with him. If I remember correctly, where I remember you writing afterwards that you hadn't felt it had been particularly successful, what you'd tried to do. Do you remember the one I'm talking about? He was kind of writing it as it went along, kind of thing.
I can't remember exactly how that happened, but there was a gig I did with Chujiko Noriko, which was kind of amazing because they didn't have a microphone at the venue. And so we projected YouTube videos of the backing tracks or something. Yes. And then we went round the audience one by one and we improvised new lyrics to the songs whispering in their ears. And sometimes Chujiko Noriko would be on one side, I'd be on the other side of the same person whispering conflicting versions. She'd be singing in Japanese, you know. That was an amazing gig. There were only about 25 people there, so we could just keep circulating and touching people's ears, whispering into their ears. It was very weird.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. I think that's one of the benefits of not playing to hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah,
I think, you know, once you go to a certain size, then stuff like that just doesn't work at all.
That gap opens up, doesn't it, between the performer and the audience?
Yeah.
You know, once you get over a certain size, you know, you're lit up on stage and they're in the dark. So you can't even see them.
Formula tends to become absolutely ironclad at a certain level of commercial success, and we've luckily never reached that level.
Oh, there you go. And that's, as we were saying at the start, that's a form of success in itself, of still being able to experiment and try these things. I mean, as you say, once you hit a certain level and you're kind of at the level of people like Bono and you know, the other very successful kind of mega artists, though artist maybe isn't the right word for Bono, once you get to that level, if you don't turn up and just crank out the songs in the way the audience expects them to be heard, they're going to kind of riot.
And again, it's back to what we were saying about internet communities. If there's, you know, 25 of you posting on a blog, then you can, you know, speak to people as individuals almost. You can develop, you know, little jokes and knowledge between you. Whereas if you're Bono and you're playing to 50,000 people in a stadium or something, it has to be as lowest common denominator as possible. So it becomes like those Facebook conversations where you're talking to your mum and your wife and your friend from school, and it's all very kind of generic.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of, and I can't remember if it's something I've mentioned on the podcast before, but any of the listeners who have listened to any of them can email me and let me know. But I remember Simon Pegg talking to Bill Bailey on Radio 4 once, and he was talking about how Bill Bailey was asking Simon Pegg about Spaced and saying the show seemed very specifically aimed at one age group. And, you know, and he asked if that was deliberate, and Simon Pegg said, yes, it was deliberately aimed at people who were born between something like 1968 and 1975 or something like that. That very kind of small kind of generation. The people who would have all been at the same school at the same time.
Generation X, basically, I think.
And he said the reason for that was that if you throw a ball to a group of people, they might drop it. But if you throw it to one person, they'll definitely catch it.
Well, that's a nice metaphor, but I'm trying to think, before we get too self-congratulatory, I'm trying to think what would be the, because all this narrow casting and clique casting is great, but what would be the alternative view? And the alternative view might be, if you did ask Bono or David Bowie or somebody like that, they might say, well, you little minnows have not actually gone for the big challenge of trying to speak to the broad church, you know, of just common humanity, and your elitists and your snobs. And actually the one interaction I've had with David Bowie on his website when he was chatting with people back in the 90s, I asked him about art magazines or something, and he said Freeze magazine was preaching to the converted, and there was almost this coded message in that saying, and you too are probably preaching to the converted, and you should actually just try and widen your message and widen your net and catch a few more people, and you could be a more major figure, and you could be more of a man. It's almost like, you know, it's a manly thing to go out there like the bullfighter and actually take on the public and take on its stupidity and its limitations and its love of formula and convention. And there might well be something in that. I mean, I don't personally agree with that. I'm happy with my little cliquey little audience, you know.
Well, I suppose one person in your little clique takes what you do and broadens it out a little bit, and someone else takes that and broadens it out a little bit.
Amanda fucking Palmer, yeah.
Well, there you go. It's, yeah.
But I mean, I suppose what you get if you have a band that decides they're going to just do the most ridiculous thing and try and push their audience as far as possible, you get somebody like Muse, who seems to be very much a Marmite band. I have said before on the show that I absolutely love them because they're so ridiculously over the top.
I think they've taken their audience a little bit of the way with them.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is always a good thing.
Yeah, and they're kind of like, each record they make, it's more ridiculously over the top than the last one. And they know what they're doing. They know that they're doing it, and they're deliberately doing it. It's not that they've accidentally gone, oh, you know, what we're doing is, you know, if anybody else likes it, it's bonus. They're kind of going, okay, let's see what we can do that pushes us even further. We'll take the formula we've initially ripped off from Radiohead, and we'll just keep on amplifying it and amplifying it and amplifying it. And I think, yeah, I think there may be an example of what you're saying, Moments, of somebody who's taken that, what could have been quite a kind of clique thing and could have been seen as kind of quite art house a few years ago, and really just magnified the most kind of populist parts of it, but have still managed to keep it completely incomprehensibly weird, if that
makes
sense.
Yeah, well, some artists do that quite well, and, you know, I'm amazed constantly by the numbers of YouTube views certain artists get and other artists don't get. I mean, if I put a video up on YouTube, it'll get anything between, 1,000 and maybe, if I'm lucky, 10,000 views. Or if it's really successful for me, it'll be up, 50,000 views or something like that. But some artists can, you know, get 42 million views, and it seems fairly effortless. And I don't really know. I will never understand what the difference is.
No, it's very strange. I mean, it's like this thing recently with Ilvis becoming very, very popular for their song about foxes. On the surface, when you can, how that became such a phenomenon is when you watch it, you can think, well, how did that happen? Because what you've actually got there is two Scandinavian, you know, comedians who are brothers making stuff clearly for themselves just to mess about. Something that was intended to be a kind of trailer for their TV show. And it's become massively popular. And it's just really stupid. But at the same time, I don't know. I have to admit also, I quite like Elvis. I've gone off and found their other songs and I sit and laugh. And if it makes me laugh, I figure that's been successful. So,
but a picture, a video on YouTube of a baby doing something cute will also make you laugh, and it will, you know, there's something really powerful and universal and subliminal about our reaction to babies or kittens or whatever it is. And obviously some people are tapping into that deliberately or accidentally and getting these huge, huge stats.
Definitely. Well, we shall draw things to a close in a minute. But before we do, I'll go to each of you in turn. What's coming up next? So, Paul, first, you tell me what's happening next, whether it's music or excuses for not making music.
It'll be a bit of both. I've got, you know, like, we're talking about playing to small audiences and, you know, sort of, if, you know, if anyone else likes it, that's a bonus and that kind of thing. What happens if you're lazy and you have that attitude is eventually you don't bother finishing the songs. So you start composing something and you go, oh, that's quite interesting, this, and you mess about with it for a while and you go, I don't actually need to go through the whole thing of, you know, mixing this down and creating an MP3 and putting it online, and that's the boring bit. So the difficult bit is not the starting the songs is the easy bit, it's the finishing the songs. So once I get around to it and actually finish some songs, but it'll be the Panther solo again. But that a bit almost, more dance floor fellas.
For what you're describing there almost sounds like a kind of almost conceptual art approach to making music. That,
well, I mean,
the idea,
like,
is all.
The, well, yeah, didn't the Residents have the theory of obscurity? which said that to make truly great art, you had to work on the principle that the audience, there would be no audience, because any time you meet, if you even started to think about an audience, you would, you know, dilute your artistic vision, because you have this audience in mind, which I think was just their way of, like, you know, coming up with an excuse for not doing anything as well. But there's an idea, there's a germ of an idea in that.
I totally have the opposite view, really. I think I'm basically exhibitionistic, and I think also I don't believe that art exists without the context in which it's displayed to people. So to me, I get really excited when I'm making a song and I have to finish it, and I have to make a video for it as soon as I finish the musical side of it, and that'll all happen in one day. So there's no question of me not finishing a song. I will finish it and I will put it up online, and I don't care if it sounds a bit broken or weird. But there is a kind of sense of a rush, almost like a plane taking off, that once the process has started, it will just go on and on for 12 hours or something, and it will result in something public. And that's an amazing rush for me, an adrenaline rush, and a kind of a sense of showing myself in public, you know, and in an exciting way, almost sexually perverse way. So I could never imagine not finishing a piece.
You see, I think I kind of sit somewhere between the two of you, because... like you, Mimus, I like to have stuff almost on display straight away as soon as I finished it. But like Paul, I kind of reach a point where the kind of the sketched idea of it is enough often. And I kind of, I've always had this attitude that I should only write a song or a piece of music as long as the material is there for it. So the song I always kind of hold up as an example of the wrong way to do this is, I think it's Sleeping Satellite by Tasmin Archer. Is it Tasmin Archer that did that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's got about 30 seconds worth of song, and she just stretches it out for ages and ages and ages. Like, the chorus just goes on forever at the end. It's like, I don't want to hear it 10 times in a row. I want to hear one verse, one chorus, and get out, because that's how much material she had for that song.
So that's what we mean about formula being ironclad. I mean, in that world, you had to do a single of a certain length. In the old days, it would have been a 1.5 minute single, and that would have been fine, but not now. Just like the publishing industry says you have to make a certain number of pages. You can't just do a novella if you're Stephen King or something. You have to do the whole thing, although he's probably just made it a novella, having said that.
But I think, so what's coming up next for you then, Mimus?
When I go back to Japan in November, I'll be finishing off my novel, my book on America, and then after that I'm doing a new album with David McClymont.
Excellent. That's exactly what we need. So if people were going to find either of you online, where would they go to get the best information? And I'll come back to you, Mimus, as you were the last person speaking.
imomus.com.
imomus.com. And Paul?
I think it's panthersolo.co.uk.
Fantastic. Guys, it's been a pleasure speaking to you both. Is there anything either of you wants to add before we wrap things up?
Yes, to an independent Scotland.
I agree. I was born in Glasgow, so I actually agree completely. Paul, what's your take on independent Scotland?
I'll go yes. I don't have a view, but I'll say yes because I'm in there. I'll get in trouble if I don't.
You see, I just want to have a Scottish passport.
I just don't want to be a refugee. That's the thing.
Oh, well, that's the point. I mean, I now own a house in England, so maybe I'll get flushed out by angry mobs of Birmingham people. But who knows? Maybe the Scots are loved all throughout the world, Paul. So we're popular, sweary people.
Yes.
We swear better than anyone else in the world. And I have to say, Peter Capaldi as Doctor Who is going to be fantastic.
Yep, look forward to that.
Cannot wait for that. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure, as I said. Thank you ever so much for joining in. I think that wraps it up for episode 19 of Future Library. If anybody wants to find out anything more about the show, you go to alonetone.com/thealex for the archives of it. It's on iTunes. It appears on petpiranha.com occasionally as well. And if you go to Twitter and you're into that kind of thing, Future Library 1. Because some other bastard got Future Library. And there's a Facebook page as well, which you can find. So that's all the connected side of things. But all that's left to say is goodbye for this show. Well, thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Future Library is brought to you by petpiranha.com.
where you could go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/futurelibrary1. So that's Future Library with a number one. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.
Thanks, goodbye. Guys. That was really good. Thank you.
No problem.
I will get that up as soon as I possibly can.
Wonderful. Do you do a lot of editing, or do you just put it up as
Should have mentioned that at the start. I do no editing.
Okay.
That's the thing I've always done, is that with all the podcasts I do, initially it was out of laziness, but now I make a virtue of it.
Yeah, it flows. It's organic, isn't it?
Yes. You could have a proper conversation, and you don't have to have little bits where there's an orchestral stab when it cuts to a different topic. So you just let it...
Also, it's that Radio 4 influence of just having talking, and actually that's fine. You know, if you do have music, just put 30 seconds of it under some talking and then fade it out quick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you, guys.
I tried to do a podcast thing like that, an edited one for Christina a few years ago. She was at a music festival. She was covering it for The Quietus. And they said, can you do a podcast? And I recorded all our interviews that she did. And it looked like we had tons of material. But once you actually edit out all the sort of ums and ahs and the coughing and the, like, you know, embarrassing sort of, you know, silences and things like that, there's actually very, very little stuff in it. And we desperately had to try and stretch it out. So I think you have to do an awful lot more work to get those slickly edited ones, I think.
Yeah.
I think... artistically better and easier to do, I think, just letting people talk, especially to people who can talk a lot like us.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, I found doing the religion podcast that we got used to not editing, and we got used to just filling all the space. So all of the guys that do it have become really quite good at just rambling on at length.
Yeah, I noticed you were pretty slick at that, jumping in and always having something lined up to say next.
I've had people come back to me after and go, oh yeah, you obviously had these questions lined up. So I have nothing lined up beforehand. I do the almost less than no preparation, embarrassingly unprepared most of the time. But I've kind of got used to just talking shit. So
you're a natural. If there's one thing you're a natural at,
you must have the gift of the Blarney. You're Irish, basically, aren't you?
Something like that. Yeah, I think my grandmother was Irish. But then, whose grandmother wasn't?
Well, true.
Exactly.
Okay, guys. Well, I shall let you go. My wife is loitering behind me in the kind of when are you finishing kind of face on. So okay. I will let you both go. Thank you ever so much, both of you. I hope to speak to you again. Okay, and I'll see you online.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers.